Gilbert Keith Worthing was Chalmers' guest, for no reason that either of them could discover. He was a British novelist of world fame, who had been popular 30 years ago. Since then, nobody bothered to read what he wrote, but everybody accepted him as a walking classic. He had been considered profound for uttering such things as, "Freedom? Do let's stop talking about freedom. Freedom is impossible. Man can never be free of hunger, of cold, of disease, of physical accidents. He can never be free of the tyranny of nature. So why should he object to the tyranny of a political dictatorship?" When all of Europe put into practice the ideas which he had preached, he came to live in America. Through the years, his style of writing and his body had grown flabby. At 70, he was an obese old man with retouched hair and a manner of scornful cynicism, retouched by quotations from the yogis about the futility of all human endeavor. Kip Chalmers had invited him because it seemed to look distinguished. Gilbert Keith Worthing had come along because he had no particular place to go.
"God damn these railroad people," said Kip Chalmers. "They're doing it on purpose. They want to ruin my campaign. I can't miss that rally. For Christ's sake, Lester, do something."
"I've tried," said Lester Tuck. At the train's last stop, he had tried, by long-distance telephone, to find air transportation to complete their journey. But there were no commercial flights scheduled for the next 2 days.
"If they don't get me there on time, I'll have their scalps and their railroad. Can't we tell that damn conductor to hurry?"
"You've told him 3 times.
I'll get him fired. He's given me nothing but a lot of alibis about all their messy technical troubles. I expect transportation, not alibis. They can't treat me like one of their day coach passengers. I expect them to get me where I want to go when I want it. Don't they know that I'm on this train?"
"They know it by now," said Laura Bradford.
"Shut up, Kip. You bore me."
Chalmers refilled his glass. The car was rocking, and the glassware tinkled faintly on the shelves of the bar. The patches of starlit sky in the windows kept swaying jerkily, and it seemed as if the stars were tinkling against one another. They could see nothing beyond the glass bay of the observation window at the end of the car, except the small halos of red and green lanterns marking the rear of the train, and a brief stretch of rail running away from them into the darkness. A wall of rock was racing the train, and the stars dipped occasionally into a sudden break that outlined high above them the peaks of the mountains of Colorado.
"Mountains," said Gilbert Keith Worthing with satisfaction. "It is a spectacle of this kind that makes one feel the insignificance of man. What is this presumptuous little bit of rail which crude materialists are so proud of building, compared to that eternal grandeur, no more than the basting thread of a seamstress on the hem of the garment of nature? If a single one of those granite giants chose to crumble, it would annihilate this train."
"Why should it choose to crumble?" asked Laura Bradford, without any particular interest.
"I think this damn train is going slower," said Kip Chalmers. "Those bastards are slowing down in spite of what I told them."
"Well, it's the mountains, you know," said Lester Tuck.
"Mountains be damned. Lester, what day is this? With all those damn changes of time, I can't tell which."
"It's May 27th, sighed Lester Tuck.
"It's May 28th, said Gilbert Keith Worthing, glancing at his watch. "It is now 20 minutes past midnight."
"Jesus!" cried Chalmers. "Then the rally is today?"
"Yep," said Lester Tuck.
"We won't make it. We—"
The train gave a sharper lurch, knocking the glass out of his hand. The thin sound of its crash against the floor, mixed with the screech of the wheel flanges tearing against the rail of a sharp curve.
"I say," asked Gilbert Keith Worthing nervously, "are your railroads safe?"
"Hell yes," said Kip Chalmers. "We've got so many rules, regulations, and controls that those bastards wouldn't dare not to be safe. Lester, how far are we now? What's the next stop?"
"There won't be any stop till Salt Lake City."
"I mean, what's the next station?"
Lester Tuck produced a soiled map, which he had been consulting every few minutes since nightfall. "Winston," he said. "Winston, Colorado." Kip Chalmers reached for another glass.
"Tinky Holloway said that Wesley said that if you don't win this election, you're through," said Laura Bradford.
She sat sprawled in her chair looking past Chalmers, studying her own face in a mirror on the wall of the lounge. She was bored, and it amused her to needle his impotent anger.
Oh, he did he?
Uh-huh. Wesley doesn't want, what's his name, whoever's running against you, to get into the legislature. If you don't win, Wesley will be sore as hell.
Tinky said, damn that bastard. He'd better watch his own neck.
Oh, I don't know. Wesley likes him very much, she added. Tinky Holloway wouldn't allow some miserable train to make him miss an important meeting. They wouldn't dare to hold him up.
Kip Chalmers sat staring at his glass. I'm going to have the government seize all the railroads, he said, his voice low.
Really? Said Gilbert Keith Worthing. I don't see why you haven't done it long ago. This is the only country on earth backward enough to permit private ownership of railroads.
Well, we're catching up with you.
Your country is so incredibly naive. It's such an anachronism. All that talk about liberty and human rights. I haven't heard it since the days of my great-grandfather. It's nothing but a verbal luxury of the rich. After all, it doesn't make any difference to the poor whether their livelihood is at the mercy of an industrialist or a bureaucrat. The day of the industrialists is over. This is the day of...
The jolt felt as if the air within the car smashed them forward, while the floor stopped under their feet. Kip Chalmers was flung down to the carpet. Gilbert Keith Worthing was thrown across the tabletop. The lights were blasted out. Glasses crashed off the shelves. The steel of the walls screamed as if about to rip open, while a long, distant thud went like a convulsion through the wheels of the train. When he raised his head, Chalmers saw that the car stood intact and still. He heard the moans of his companions and the first shriek of Laura Bradford's hysterics. He crawled along the floor to the doorway, wrenched it open, and tumbled down the steps. Far ahead on the side of a curve, he saw moving flashlights and a red glow at a spot where the engine had no place to be. He stumbled through the darkness, bumping into half-clothed figures that waved the futile little flares of matches. Somewhere along the line, he saw a man with a flashlight and seized his arm. It was the conductor.
What happened? Gasped Chalmers.
Split rail, the conductor answered impassively. The engine went off the track.
Off?
On its side.
Anybody killed?
No, the engineer's all right. The fireman is hurt.
Split rail? What do you mean, split rail?
The conductor's face had an odd look. It was grim, accusing, and closed.
Rail wears out, Mr. Chalmers, he answered with a strange kind of emphasis.
Particularly on curves. Didn't you know that it was worn out?
We knew.
Well, why didn't you have it replaced?
It was going to be replaced. But Mr. Losey canceled that.
Who was Mr. Losey?
The man who is not our operating vice president. Chalmers wondered why the conductor seemed to look at him as if something about the catastrophe were his fault.
Well, aren't you going to put the engine back on the track?
That engine's never going to be put back on any track from the looks of it.
But it's got to move us.
It can't. Beyond the few moving flares and the dulled sound of screams, Chalmers sensed suddenly, not wanting to look at it, the black immensity of the mountains, the silence of hundreds of uninhabited miles, and the precarious strip of a ledge hanging between a wall of rock and an abyss. He gripped the conductor's arm tighter.
But what are we going to do?
The engineer's gone to call Winston.
Call? How?
There's a phone a couple of miles down the track.
Will they get us out of here?
They will.
But...
Then his mind made a connection with the past and the future, and his voice rose to a scream for the first time.
How long will we have to wait?
I don't know, said the conductor. He threw Chalmers' hand off his arm and walked away. The night operator of Winston Station listened to the phone message, dropped the receiver, and raced up the stairs to shake the station agent out of bed. The station agent was a husky, surly drifter who had been assigned to the job 10 days ago by order of the new division superintendent. He stumbled dazedly to his feet, but he was knocked awake when the operator's words reached his brain.
What? He gasped. Jesus, the comet? Well, don't stand there shaking. Call Silver Springs.
the night dispatcher of the division headquarters at Silver Springs, listened to the message, then telephoned Dave Mitchum, the new superintendent of the Colorado division.
"The Comet?" gasped Mitchum, his hand pressing the telephone receiver to his ear, his feet hitting the floor and throwing him upright out of bed. "The engine done for? The diesel?"
"Yes, sir."
"Oh, God. Oh, God almighty, what are we going to do?" Then, remembering his position, he added, "Well, send out the wrecking train."
"I have."
"Call the operator at Sherwood to hold all traffic."
"I have."
"What have you got on the sheet?"
"The Army Freight Special westbound. But it's not due for about 4 hours. It's running late."
"I'll be right down." "Wait, listen, get Bill, Sandy, and Clarence down by the time I get there. There's going to be hell to pay."
Dave Mitchum had always complained about injustice, because he said he had always had bad luck. He explained it by speaking darkly about the conspiracy of the big fellows, who would never give him a chance, though he did not explain just whom he meant by the big fellows. Seniority of service was his favorite topic of complaint, and sole standard of value. He had been in the railroad business longer than many men who had advanced beyond him. This, he said, was proof of the social system's injustice, though he never explained just what he meant by the social system. He had worked for many railroads, but had not stayed long with any one of them. His employers had had no specific misdeeds to charge against him, but had simply eased him out because he said, "Nobody told me to," too often. He did not know that he owed his present job to a deal between James Taggart and Wesley Mooch. When Taggart traded to Mooch the secret of his sister's private life, in exchange for a raise in rates, Mooch made him throw in an extra favor by their customary rules of bargaining, which consisted of squeezing all one could out of any given trade. The extra was a job for Dave Mitchum, who was the brother-in-law of Claude Slagenhop, who was the president of the Friends of Global Progress, who were regarded by Mooch as a valuable influence on public opinion. James Taggart pushed the responsibility of finding a job for Mitchum onto Clifton Losey. Losey pushed Mitchum into the first job that came up, superintendent of the Colorado division, when the man holding it quit without notice. The man quit when the extra diesel engine of Winston Station was given to Chick Morrison's special.
"What are we going to do?" cried Dave Mitchum, rushing half-dressed and groggy with sleep into his office, where the chief dispatcher, the trainmaster, and the road foreman of engines were waiting for him.
The three men did not answer. They were middle-aged men, with years of railroad service behind them. A month ago they would have volunteered their advice in any emergency, but they were beginning to learn that things had changed, and that it was dangerous to speak.
"What in hell are we going to do?"
"One thing is certain," said Bill Brent, the chief dispatcher. "We can't send a train into the tunnel with a coal-burning engine."
Dave Mitchum's eyes grew sullen. He knew that this was the one thought on all their minds. He wished Brent had not named it.
"Well, where do we get a diesel?" he asked angrily.
"We don't," said the road foreman.
"But we can't keep the Comet waiting on a siding all night."
"Looks like we'll have to," said the trainmaster.
"What's the use of talking about it, Dave? You know that there is no diesel anywhere on the division." "But Christ almighty, how do they expect us to move trains without engines?"
"Miss Taggart didn't," said the road foreman. "Mr. Losey does."
"Bill," asked Mitchum, in the tone of pleading for a favor, "isn't there anything transcontinental that's due tonight with any sort of a diesel?"
"The first one to come," said Bill Brent implacably, "will be number 236, the fast freight from San Francisco, which is due at Winston at 7:18 a.m. He added, "That's the diesel closest to us at this moment, I've checked."
"What about the Army special?"
"Better not think about it, Dave. That one has superiority over everything on the line, including the Comet, by order of the Army. They're running late as it is. Journal boxes caught fire twice. They're carrying munitions for the West Coast arsenals. Better pray that nothing stops them on your division. If you think we'll catch hell for holding the Comet, it's nothing to what we'll catch if we try to stop that special."
They remained silent. The windows were open to the summer night, and they could hear the ringing of the telephone in the dispatcher's office downstairs. The signal lights winked over the deserted yards that had once been a busy division point. Mitchum looked toward the roundhouse where the black silhouettes of a few steam engines stood outlined in a dim light.
"The tunnel," he said, and stopped. "Is 8 miles long," said the train master, with a harsh emphasis. "I was only thinking," snapped Mitchum. "Better not think of it," said Brent softly. "I haven't said anything." "What was that talk you had with Dick Horton before he quit?" the road foreman asked too innocently, as if the subject were irrelevant. "Wasn't it something about the ventilation system of the tunnel being on the bum? Didn't he say that that tunnel was hardly safe nowadays, even for diesel engines?"
"Why did you bring that up?" snapped Mitchum. "I haven't said anything."
Dick Horton, the division chief engineer, had quit 3 days after Mitchum's arrival. "I thought I'd just mention it," the road foreman answered innocently. "Look, Dave," said Bill Brent, knowing that Mitchum would stall for another hour rather than formulate a decision. "You know that there's only one thing to do. Hold the Comet at Winston till morning, wait for number 236, have her diesel take the Comet through the tunnel. Then let the Comet finish her run with the best coal burner we can give her on the other side."
"But how late will that make her?"
Brent shrugged. 12 hours? 18 hours? Who knows?"
18 hours? For the Comet? Christ, that's never happened before."
"None of what's been happening to us has ever happened before," said Brent, with an astonishing sound of weariness in his brisk, competent voice.
"But they'll blame us for it in New York. They'll put all the blame on us."
Brent shrugged. A month ago he would have considered such an injustice inconceivable. Today he knew better. "I guess," said Mitchum miserably, "I guess there's nothing else that we can do." "There isn't, Dave."
"Oh, God. Why did this have to happen to us?"
"Who is John Galt?" It was 2:30 when the Comet, pulled by an old switch engine, jerked to a stop on a siding of Winston Station. Kip Chalmers glanced out with incredulous anger at the few shanties on a desolate mountainside, and at the ancient hovel of a station.
"Now what? What in hell are they stopping here for?" he cried, and rang for the conductor.
With the return of motion and safety, his terror had turned into rage. He felt almost as if he had been cheated by having been made to experience an unnecessary fear. His companions were still clinging to the tables of the lounge. They felt too shaken to sleep. "How long?" the conductor said impassively in answer to his question. "Till morning, Mr. Chalmers." Chalmers stared at him, stupefied.
"We're going to stand here till morning?"
"Yes, Mr. Chalmers."
"Here?"
"Yes."
"But I have a rally in San Francisco in the evening."
The conductor did not answer.
"Why? Why do we have to stand? Why in hell? What happened?"
Slowly, patiently, with contemptuous politeness, the conductor gave him an exact account of the situation. But years ago in grammar school, in high school, in college, Kip Chalmers had been taught that man does not and need not live by reason.
"Damn your tunnel," he screamed. "Do you think I'm going to let you hold me up because of some miserable tunnel? Do you want to wreck vital national plans on account of a tunnel? Tell your engineer that I must be in San Francisco by evening, and that he's got to get me there."
"How?"
"That's your job, not mine."
"There is no way to do it."
"Then find a way, goddamn you."
The conductor did not answer.
"Do you think I'll let your miserable technological problems interfere with crucial social issues? Do you know who I am? Tell that engineer to start moving if he values his job."
"The engineer has his orders."
"Orders be damned. I give the orders these days. Tell him to start at once."
"Perhaps you'd better speak to the station agent, Mr. Chalmers." "I have no authority to answer you as I'd like to," said the conductor, and walked out. Chalmers leaped to his feet. "Say, Kip," said Lester Tuck uneasily, "maybe it's true. Maybe they can't do it."
"They can if they have to," snapped Chalmers, marching resolutely to the door.
Years ago, in college, he had been taught that the only effective means to impel men to action was fear. In the dilapidated office of Winston Station, he confronted a sleepy man with slack, worn features and a frightened young boy who sat at the operator's desk. They listened in silent stupor to a stream of profanity such as they had never heard from any section gang.
"And it's not my problem how you get the train through the tunnel. That's for you to figure out," Chalmers concluded. But if you don't get me an engine and don't start that train, you can kiss goodbye to your job, your work permits, and this whole goddamn railroad."
The station agent had never heard of Kip Chalmers, and did not know the nature of his position. But he knew that this was the day when unknown men in undefined positions held unlimited power, the power of life or death.
"It's not up to us, Mr. Chalmers," he said pleadingly. "We don't issue the orders out here. The order came from Silver Springs. Suppose you telephone Mr. Mitchum, and—"
"Who's Mr. Mitchum?"
"He's the division superintendent at Silver Springs. Suppose you send him a message to—"
"I should bother with a division superintendent. I'll send a message to Jim Taggart. That's what I'm going to do."
Before the station agent had time to recover, Chalmers whirled to the boy, ordering,
"You, take this down and send it at once."
It was a message which, a month ago, the station agent would not have accepted from any passenger. The rules forbade it. But he was not certain about any rules any longer. Mr. James Taggart, New York City, am held up on the Comet at Winston, Colorado, by the incompetence of your men, who refuse to give me an engine. Have meeting in San Francisco in the evening of top-level national importance. If you don't move my train at once, I'll let you guess the consequences. Kip Chalmers. After the boy had transmitted the words onto the wires that stretched from pole to pole across a continent as guardians of the Taggart track, after Kip Chalmers had returned to his car to wait for an answer, the station agent telephoned Dave Mitchum, who was his friend, and read to him the text of the message. He heard Mitchum groan in answer.
"I thought I'd tell you, Dave. I never heard of the guy before, but maybe he's somebody important."
"I don't know," moaned Mitchum.
"Kip Chalmers? You see his name in the newspapers all the time, right in with all the top-level boys. I don't know what he is, but if he's from Washington, we can't take any chances.
Oh, Christ, what are we going to do?"
"We can't take any chances," thought the Taggart operator in New York, and transmitted the message by telephone to James Taggart's home. It was close to 6 a.m. in New York, and James Taggart was awakened out of the fitful sleep of a restless night. He listened to the telephone, his face sagging. He felt the same fear as the station agent of Winston, and for the same reason. He called the home of Clifton Losey. All the rage which he could not pour upon Kip Chalmers was poured over the telephone wire upon Clifton Losey.
"Do something," screamed Taggart. "I don't care what you do. It's your job, not mine, but see to it that that train gets through. What in hell is going on? I never heard of the Comet being held up. Is that how you run your department? It's a fine thing when important passengers have to start sending messages to me. At least when my sister ran the place, I wasn't awakened in the middle of the night over every spike that broke in Iowa. Colorado, I mean."
"I'm so sorry, Jim," said Clifton Losey smoothly, in a tone that balanced apology, reassurance, and the right degree of patronizing confidence.
"It's just a misunderstanding. It's somebody's stupid mistake. Don't worry, I'll take care of it. I was, as a matter of fact, in bed, but I'll attend to it at once." Clifton Losey was not in bed. He had just returned from a round of nightclubs in the company of a young lady. He asked her to wait and hurried to the offices of Taggart Transcontinental. None of the night staff who saw him there could say why he chose to appear in person, but neither could they say that it had been unnecessary. He rushed in and out of several offices, was seen by many people, and gave an impression of great activity. The only physical result of it was an order that went over the wires to Dave Mitchum, superintendent of the Colorado Division. "Give an engine to Mr. Chalmers at once. Send the Comet through safely and without unnecessary delay. If you are unable to perform your duties, I shall hold you responsible before the Unification Board. Clifton Losey." Then, calling his girlfriend to join him, Clifton Losey drove to a country roadhouse to make certain that no one would be able to find him in the next few hours. The dispatcher at Silver Springs was baffled by the order that he handed to Dave Mitchum. But Dave Mitchum understood. He knew that no railroad order would ever speak in such terms as giving an engine to a passenger. He knew that the thing was a showpiece. He guessed what sort of show was being staged, and he felt a cold sweat at the realization of who was being framed as the goat of the show. "What's the matter, Dave?" asked the trainmaster. Mitchum did not answer. He seized the telephone, his hand shaking as he begged for a connection to the Taggart operator in New York.
He looked like an animal in a trap. He begged the New York operator to get him Mr. Clifton Losey's home. The operator tried. There was no answer. He begged the operator to keep on trying and to try every number he could think of where Mr. Losey might be found. The operator promised, and Mitchum hung up, but knew that it was useless to wait or to speak to anyone in Mr. Losey's department. "What's the matter, Dave?" Mitchum handed him the order, and saw by the look on the trainmaster's face that the trap was as bad as he had suspected. He called the region headquarters of Taggart Transcontinental at Omaha, Nebraska, and begged to speak to the general manager of the region. There was a brief silence on the wire. Then the voice of the Omaha operator told him that the general manager had resigned and vanished 3 days ago. "Over a little trouble with Mr. Losey," the voice added. He asked to speak to the assistant general manager in charge of his particular district, but the assistant was out of town for the weekend and could not be reached.
"Get me somebody else," Mitchum screamed. "Anybody of any district. For Christ's sake, get me somebody who'll tell me what to do."
The man who came on the wire was the assistant general manager of the Iowa-Minnesota district. "What?" he interrupted at Mitchum's first words. "At Winston, Colorado? Why in hell are you calling me?" "No, don't tell me what happened. I don't want to know it." "No," I said, "no, you're not going to frame me into having to explain afterwards why I did or didn't do anything about whatever it is. It's not my problem. Speak to some region executive. Don't pick on me. What do I have to do with Colorado?" "Oh, hell, I don't know. Get the chief engineer. Speak to him." The chief engineer of the central region answered impatiently, "Yes, what? What is it?" And Mitchum rushed desperately to explain. When the chief engineer heard that there was no diesel, he snapped, "Then hold the train, of course." When he heard about Mr. Chalmers, he said, his voice suddenly subdued, "Kip Chalmers, of Washington? Well, I don't know. That would be a matter for Mr. Losey to decide." When Mitchum said, "Mr. Losey ordered me to arrange it, but—" the chief engineer snapped in great relief, "Then do exactly as Mr. Losey says," and hung up. Dave Mitchum replaced the telephone receiver cautiously. He did not scream any longer. Instead, he tiptoed to a chair, almost as if he were sneaking. He sat looking at Mr. Losey's order for a long time. Then he snatched a glance about the room. The dispatcher was busy at his telephone. The trainmaster and the road foreman were there, but they pretended that they were not waiting. He wished Bill Brent, the chief dispatcher, would go home. Bill Brent stood in a corner watching him. Brent was a short, thin man with broad shoulders. He was 40, but looked younger. He had the pale face of an office worker and the hard, lean features of a cowboy. He was the best dispatcher on the system. Mitchum rose abruptly and walked upstairs to his office, clutching Losey's order in his hand. Dave Mitchum was not good at understanding problems of engineering and transportation, but he understood men like Clifton Losey. He understood the kind of game the New York executives were playing, and what they were now doing to him. The order did not tell him to give Mr. Chalmers a coal-burning engine, just an engine. If the time came to answer questions, wouldn't Mr. Losey gasp in shocked indignation that he had expected a division superintendent to know that only a diesel engine could be meant in that order? The order stated that he was to send the Comet through safely. Wasn't a division superintendent expected to know what was safe? And without unnecessary delay. What was an unnecessary delay? If the possibility of a major disaster was involved, wouldn't a delay of a week or a month be considered necessary? The New York executives did not care, thought Mitchum. They did not care whether Mr. Chalmers reached his meeting on time or whether an unprecedented catastrophe struck their rails. They cared only about making sure that they would not be blamed for either. If he held the train, they would make him the scapegoat to appease the anger of Mr. Chalmers. If he sent the train through, and it did not reach the western portal of the tunnel, they would put the blame on his incompetence. They would claim that he had acted against their orders in either case. What would he be able to prove? To whom? One could prove nothing to a tribunal that had no stated policy, no defined procedure, no rules of evidence, no binding principles. a tribunal such as the Unification Board, that pronounced men guilty or innocent as it saw fit, with no standard of guilt or innocence.